episode of the Effective Statistician, and today I'm super happy to have Oliver Keen on this show, and I can't believe he hasn't been on it before. A couple of years ago, we had a really, really nice discussions about estimands as part of a PSI conference, where we did some kind of role play, and he was one of the key person involved in preparing all of these, and we had these different viewpoints from the sponsor, the regulator, the HTA guy, and all these kind of different viewpoints. And I remember at the time I was kind of defending the HTA position on estimands at that time and was strongly favoring treatment policy. And Steve Ruberg was the patient voice, and he was favoring kind of this on-treatment approach because all the patients that he talked to said, well, if I take this medication to the end, how will it work? And so that was really, really insightful discussion. And I think if you scroll back quite a lot of episodes, there should be some discussion with Steve Ruberg about this. And of course, you can check out the PSI video on demand part. I'm pretty sure it's on there as well as part of a conference. So with that, hi, Oliver, how are you doing?
Hi, Alexander. Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me on your podcast, and congratulations on having 300 episodes, I think it is.
Over 300 episodes. Yeah.
I think it's fantastic way of getting statistics discussed more widely among people. And you covered such a lot of ground, had some very eminent speakers on. So I feel privileged to be part of it.
I had speakers from all kind of different areas and also experience levels. Yeah, from people that are new grads up to people that, you know, had decades of careers, professors, senior leaders from companies, but also kind of, you know, project statisticians, you know, that work in the trenches. So, and that I think makes me really, really happy. You have a long career already. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Yeah. I worked for over 30 years in the pharmaceutical industry, working for GSK as a statistician. I'm now an independent consultant. I mean, it was a long and very varied career. I'd always enjoyed it. It's always been challenging. The industry has never stayed the same over that period. It was always evolving. I always felt I was learning new things. So, yeah, and I continue to enjoy working in the industry.
Yeah, so if you want to work with a really experienced consultant, Oliver is definitely a person to go to. And of course, I'll connect his LinkedIn profile into the podcast show notes. Today, we'll talk about estimands. So, and for sure, this hasn't been, you know, the first time that we have talked about estimands. And we'll specifically talk about estimands in the situation where you have continuous endpoints collected over time. Yeah, like in psychiatry, for example, you have a lot of these different questionnaires, but could be any kind of continuous endpoint. And I remember quite some time ago, Craig Mallinckrodt did a lot of research about different ways to estimate things, like MMRM, LOCF. That was, you know, kind of about 20 years ago, a big, big topic. And at the time, he was strongly favoring MMRM over LOCF and made this estimation technique a very, very prevalent thing. And it's nowadays also very easy to implement, both in R and SaaS, of course. And so that has helped a lot to make it widely used. Now, recently, actually, this year in 2023, Ting published an article and advocated, for or discussed what could be kind of different estimates around this. And as a response to this, Oliver, together with a couple of other authors, David Wright, Daniel Breton, Thomas Drury, Sunita Rihal, and Ian White, so a couple of really, really famous names, responded to this. And this is what we want to talk about today. So, Oliver, from your point of view, what's the first most important point you have about the paper from Ting?
Okay, well, let me first of all, you know, start. You said this was a collaborative work, and I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed working with my co-authors, Sunita, Dan, Tom, David, and Ian. And it was really great to be part of a project with, you know, people who are such experts on the subject of estimands. I mean, estimands has always been something that I've been really interested in, right back from when the US NIH published their tract on missing data. I mean, it's always interested me, you know, what treatment effect you're actually estimating it in a clinical trial. And this comes back to, you know, even before estimands, the idea of intent to treat analysis and what exactly did that mean. So I really welcome the introduction of the estimands framework. I think that's been really important. And obviously the group saw this article by Natie Ting, and we came together. You know, this is Ian White works in academia, and all of us work for different companies. And we felt quite strongly the article had some misconceptions about the ICHE9 estimands framework. And we felt uncomfortable with the arguments that were being put forward for a broad adoption of last observation analysis.
Yeah, that is the first point. What actually is last observation analysis? I know last observation carried forward analysis, but what is the difference to last observation analysis?
Well, in practice, I think the point Natie Ting makes in the article is that essentially they're the same thing. I mean, conventionally, traditionally, we've always thought of last observation carried forwards. You know, that's the idea that if somebody discontinues the treatment, you take the last observation on the treatment and use that as, you know, for future time points right through to the final time point of the study. I think the distinction he was making was he didn't see any kind of carrying forward, that he sees the last observation, that is the kind of the outcome for the patient is the last observation. So he's trying to make that kind of distinction. Mm-hmm. But that really then brings into question, is that really a treatment, an appropriate estimate for a treatment policy approach?
Okay, so let's untangle this a little bit. So the first point, I think, is that estimation is one thing and defining the estimate is a completely different thing. What should drive what?
Yes, I mean, I think current views is you define your estimand first and then consider what's an appropriate estimation strategy for your estimand. Within the paper, some of this gets a little confused, I think, between, you know, starting an estimation and then kind of justifying it with the estimand and the strategies. I think, as you say, I think it's important to define your estimand first and then consider, you know, what are the appropriate estimation strategies?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You always first need to start with your end in mind. Yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then it's about kind of, okay, and how do I now approach that? Of course, if you then come up with something that is not estimable, then, well, probably you need to go back. But
yeah, that's always the, you know, there's always this kind of iteration between what you would ideally like and what you can estimate. But I don't think, I mean, people seem to think that, for example, that treatment policy is easy to estimate. Well, actually, it's not. When you've got missing data, it's actually one of the more it is quite difficult because you have to make assumptions about the missing data. So
okay. Yeah,
sometimes there's misconceptions about what's easy to estimate as well.
So let's dive a little bit into treatment policy here first. Yeah,
okay, sure.
So treatment policy, and correct me if I'm wrong, basically speaks about you decide at the start of your treatment how exactly you will treat patients. Yeah. And then you analyze accordingly. So for me, that would basically mean, okay, let's estimate, yeah, what is the outcome of a decision we make at baseline. And this decision is, okay, we start with treatment A versus we start with treatment B. Or we start with treatment A, and in case something happens, so we'll do this, or versus B, and in case something happens, we will do this. Yeah. So for example, it could also mean we start with treatment A, and if it doesn't work, we increase the dose. Yeah. And then we observe the outcome, or we have treatment B, and if it doesn't work, we increase the dose. Yeah. But see, the policy needs to be clear, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think that's, it's an interesting the way you kind of described it, but I think I worry about the way you're thinking of treatment policy, because that assumes that would be true if everybody followed the protocol, if everybody did what was said in it. And the whole point of the SDN strategy is you have people who discontinue medication, who take medications that in theory are not allowed by the protocol, who once they discontinue the trial can do what discontinue medication, they can go on to whatever medications they want. So I think that's one of the difficulties, you know, with thinking of treatment policy in that sense, in that way, in the way that you've described. I mean, I would worry about that. I think treatment policy more, it's better to think of it as an effective assignment. So all you're thinking of is, you know, if we originally assign a patient to these different medications, what is their ultimate outcome? You can try and control it as much as you can in the protocol in terms of, well, if this doesn't happen, that. But in real life, as we know, trials, people discontinue their medication. They don't follow what's in the protocol. They don't, you know, if A fails, they don't necessarily go on to, you know, that trip. So no, I think that's one of the difficulties, the misunderstandings about treatment policy. It's you're going to end up, you know, once people have discontinued the treatment, they can do, you know, it's the discretion of the investigator what they get.
Of course. It is, but of course you could have treatment defined as something that is based on some kind of patient post-baseline variables. You have that all the time, yeah? So that you treat to target or things like this, yeah? Or you have certain kind of ways to manage co-medication or things like this, yeah? So you could include that in your treatment decision, in your treatment, well, not in your treatment decision, in how you define treatment. Yeah. So I think that is the, in when you think about the estimate framework, one of the things you need to be really clear about is about what is treatment A? Yeah. What is that really? And it could be, well, starting with this molecule, but it could also be a certain strategy. Yeah. That you, of course, if then patients or physicians deviate from the strategy, you could get missing data. Yeah. That is completely see that. Yeah. But I think that, and then managing the missing data is yet another point. First, you need to define what is really your treatment strategy.
Yeah. But you also, I mean, just to say, you will also have data. You may not have missing data. You'll have data, but you'll have data from people who have followed different treatment policies. You know, they've taken it. You know, treatment policy, if your strategy is treatment policy, you have to, that is the data. That's the data you've got to use, regardless of what you know, what's led them to those particular outcomes, what policy, what set of treatments they've used.
Well, I'm not sure. Because if you say your treatment policy is treatment A, you start with that, and then whatever the physician describes or does is your treatment policy, yeah. Then you never have any missing data, of course, yeah, because you will always have complete data, and then you can analyze as you randomize. Very, very easy, yeah. The drawback, of course, is that it's very, very hard then to later on describe what is the treatment, especially if things change in terms of background and all these kind of other things. Yeah. And you don't know at the start, of course, how many patients will deviate. Yeah. They don't really deviate because you include any deviation in your treatment definition. Yeah. So then you basically move the problem from the intercurrent events into the treatment definition, like what you sometimes do with the composite endpoint. You move it into the endpoint definition. Yeah. So these are, of course, both possible scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be interesting, perhaps we can get on to talk about composite and, other strategies. I think, obviously, going back to the Ting paper is very dismissive of any strategy other than treatment policy or interestingly, while on treatment. And particularly, the paper is very dismissive of the hypothetical strategy. And I think sometimes that word, hypothetical, is kind of problematic to people because it sort of sounds like something that didn't happen. Well, I'm only interested in the facts.
But I think the wording is not really helpful.
No, people react against it. I'm a scientist. I'm interested in facts. I'm not interested in what might have happened. But I think a better way to think of a hypothetical strategy, how I've been trying to think of it more recently. I mean, the important thing is it can address causal questions of what is the treatment actually doing? I think these are important scientific questions. They're important clinical questions. I think, because we think so much in regulatory terms and HTA terms and what is the policy? What's the effect of this policy? But to an individual patient, I think, and for science as well, I think it's important to try and address questions of what does that treatment itself do? What is the causal effect of that treatment? And if you think of it that way, then the hypothetical strategy doesn't sound so, unattractive, because you're actually trying to get at what does that treatment actually do?
Yeah, so hypothetical strategy could be something like, if I tolerate the treatment and everything works fine and I don't discontinue, what will be my outcome after 8 weeks of treatment? Yeah. And I think this is really kind of a question about, you can make this assumption. Why not? Yeah. Why is that a better assumption than any other assumption that you're making?
We wouldn't call it an assumption as such. I mean, I think assumption might that's a word.
Well, a condition.
Worry about. Okay. I think it's a treatment effect you would be interested in. I would be interested in as a patient. If I'm looking at a drug label, I worry a little bit. I do take medications. I look at the labels, and it says treatment A will have this effect. If I take it. But I know that that's a mixture of people who have taken the medication and people who haven't. I don't expect the treatment to work if I don't take it. And it's that kind of average. It's not telling me, what is the, if I take this treatment for the length of the period, what can I expect in terms of benefit? It doesn't tell me that. It tells me a policy type, outcome, which will be a mix of people. Some people have taken it the whole time. Some people have gone on to other treatments. That's the estimate that corresponds to a treatment policy approach. And I think there are really interesting questions around, what effect is this treatment actually causing itself?
Yeah, I think this is also especially interesting if you also think about dose response things, if you think about, do you want to better understand method of action, all these kind of different things. Yeah, there's, not everything that we do is a phase 3 study. And so, therefore, I think there's a lot of area for having this as well. And as you said, even for a phase 3 study, from patient point of view, that could still be interesting. Yeah. My main point very often is we shouldn't tell people what they should be interested in. I think we should explain people what the different things mean so they can make an informed decision about what they are really interested in. I think it's kind of, it's not very patient-centric, physician-centric, decision-maker-centric, that we are so arrogant to basically be saying, I know better what you want to hear. Yeah? No, I don't. Yeah? And so I'm absolutely in favor of, you know, describing, training, making clear that people can make an informed choice. Yeah. And so just from that point of view, yeah, I would never write a sentence like, for longitudinal data analysis, while on treatment strategy and treatment policy strategy are more appropriate than hypothetical strategy. Why? Yeah. I think they are all, you know, equally important from the get-go, and it's a personal decision what's most appropriate for you.
Yeah, but I think they address different questions. And,
exactly.
You know, it goes back to what we were saying, you've got to define what, you know, what treatment effects you're interested in. And in some cases, that will be treatment policy. In some cases, that may be hypothetical. It may be composite. You know, there are situations where all of these provide treatment effects that are of interest.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's another point about kind of this treatment policy and then kind of this, that last observation is actually a valid way to look into treatment policy. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's clearly misguided. I mean, a treatment policy approach requires follow-up off treatments. You can't just use the last observation as your method of estimation. I think that's generally agreed. You know, a treatment policy, you need to get the outcomes of the patient. And if they're missing, you've got to do some imputation or make some assumptions about what would have happened to that patient, you know, using some kind of multiple imputation strategy to try and get a valid estimate for a treatment policy strategy. I think what's being described when you talk about last observation actually corresponds, it's an estimation method more for a composite type strategy, I would say, if anything. I'm not necessarily saying it's a good way of estimating a composite strategy, but in some senses you're, you know, if you're using last observation, you're penalizing people who, you know, if you say they discontinue treatment and will use their last observation, if that's a bad observation, you're kind of somehow saying, well, this is a composite, and you know, we're trying to say discontinuation is a bad thing, and for those people who discontinue, we'll plug in their last observation.
Well, that assumes that the patients improve. Yeah.
Well, it's reflected that the discontinuation part is reflected in the last observation. Yeah. I mean, that's an argument you might make. I'm not saying I agree with it, but it's an argument you could make that last observation is a type of estimation strategy for a composite. You know, you do have to make it very clear then with saying discontinuation is, you know, making that part of the endpoint. And as part of the endpoint, you know, how we're going to estimate it is to penalize it, and we're going to penalize it by using the last observation. I mean, that's the kind of argument you'd have to make. But I don't think you can say that last observation analysis is an appropriate analysis for a treatment policy. I don't think that's really.
I think my point is this, you know, if we look into continuous data over time, we can have two different scenarios. One is, and that is what lots of people thinking about, is kind of, we have patients that have very bad symptoms at baseline, and then we give them treatment and the symptoms improve. Yeah. And then usually the patients that drop out early have least improvement. Now, there could be another scenario where patients have some kind of stable symptoms and they actually worsen over time. And the treatment delays the worsening or decreases the worsening. And then, of course, any patients that drop out early have better outcomes. Yeah?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So I think in terms of what you penalize depends a little bit on these two different settings.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I entirely agree. And that was always one of the problems. If we go back in time when people were using last observation carried forward in these kind of areas where diseases get worse over time, because it's not a, I mean, it's not a good strategy in that sense. As you say, it wouldn't penalize people. It would actually benefit people who discontinue early if you're in the situation where people are getting worse, as time progresses. Yes. I mean, then clearly it's not appropriate. You'd have to think of some other way of penalizing.
And so that also clearly shows that you need to look into the clinical aspects here. Yeah.
Yes.
Is it a treat? What is usually the course of treatment? Yeah. Do you have, a very fast response and then, a decline thereafter? Or do you look into reducing the, worsening of symptoms? All these kind of different things you need to take into account, and you can't just say, well, that is better than this. It really depends on the clinical setup. There's this one other concept that Ting speaks about, this one patient, one vote. What is your viewpoint on this, and what does it actually mean?
Yes, I mean, I think well, it always sounds attractive, one patient, one vote. Everybody likes to be treated equally and so on. I mean, I think we made clear in the article that we think one patient, one vote should be applied to the estimand itself. So that doesn't mean to say that when you do an estimation, you have to weight everybody equally in the analysis. It's the estimand where it's one patient, one vote as such. The point here is that you might be able to estimate somebody's outcome better by using other patients' data. So when your estimation method, you can actually weight other people because their data will give you more information about the patient who's got the missing data, for example. So I think again that's an important point. I mean, I think we're saying one patient, one vote for the estimand, not for the estimation.
Yes, that is a very, very important thing. And honestly, we are not here. That's not a democratic vote. We are interested really in understanding what's going on.
Well, you want to find the best way of estimation. I mean, the other point I think with the paper, it's very critical of MMRM as a method of estimation, and I think actually it can be useful, particularly for treatment policy estimands. Actually, recent work that's been going on within the Estimands Implementation Working Group is coming up with some very good ways of actually using MMRM for estimating treatment policy estimands, where you're dividing the data into on and off treatment periods. I think it worries me that, well, it worries us that MMRM was so heavily dismissed in this paper, whereas when I think it's actually can be a very useful method of estimation.
I think that speaks very much to the point of how we communicate these more complex approaches. Of course, last observation is very, very easy to communicate.
Yes.
Yet that shouldn't make us you always use and go the easy route. That shouldn't be kind of just because it's easy, we do it.
Yes.
If it's not appropriate. Nevertheless, I think as a community, we can improve a lot on how we communicate the more complex approaches. I have seen so many publications that speak about, oh, the estimand is a multiple imputation estimand. And I was thinking, like, what the hell have you imputed here? Under what assumptions? Multiple imputation is just a very general framework. It doesn't tell you how you impute, under which assumptions, when do you impute, and so on. And we should go back from just stating we have used statistical technique XYZ to what does it actually tell you? And I think that is where we as statisticians need to get from our technical into more kind of plain language,
Yes.
and explain it this way.
Yes. I mean, we agree, obviously agree, you know, communication is key. And I think, you know, that goes back to what I was saying about the hypothetical thing. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about, you know, what that's actually trying to estimate, what treatment effect you're targeting with a hypothetical strategy.
Okay, very good. So as a final summary, what is your key takeaway from this whole discussion about continuous outcomes and estimates?
Difficult question. I think it shows there's still a lot of debate even within the statistical community about these issues, and that there are still some parts of the community that are still in favor of things like last observation carried forward. I think the estimands framework itself is a massive step forward in trying to think about how we estimate treatment effects in clinical trials. I think the next stage is really around, for me, is thinking about causal inference as well, which is a sort of not really covered that well, or not covered in detail in the ICHE9 framework. But I think that's very important to me, you know, to think about causal questions as well as questions of treatment policy. I think, you know, going forward, that's going to be a major area where we, you know, as statisticians, we need to get involved.
Completely agree. There is still a lot of education needed within the stats community, and even more outside of the statistics community. And so invest in answering and questioning what is really the problem here. In the course about estimates that I've recorded together with Kaspar Rufibach, we go a lot into this. And he always says, like, if people kind of write him a quick email about, oh, what should we do? It usually ends up in a meeting where he asks lots of different questions and say, first, I think we first need to really think about this a little bit more. And so this thought process is the biggest benefit, I think, yeah, because then we really get clear on what we really want rather than kind of directly going to the estimation problem. And with that, completely confusing the overall problem-solving technique. And all the discussions that we had today really clarifies this. So thanks a lot, Oliver, for that. And we will put the link to the references, a link to your LinkedIn page and all the other things into the show notes. So check out the show notes on theeffectivestatistician.com. Thanks so much, Oliver.
Well, thank you very much, Alexander, for the opportunity.